Good morning, everyone. How's everyone enjoying Symposium? Has it been good? Okay, great. It's been really great for me. I've had lots of opportunities to talk to people about algae, which I love to do. And I'm sorry, I apologize. I think you were asking for directions the other day, and I thought you wanted to talk about algae for 15 or 20 minutes. I obviously love algae, but I'm not the only person. If you kind of look at what's going on out there, you hear about it daily. It's on Twitter. If you go in and search algae on Twitter, you would be amazed what you find. A lot of popular magazines, NBC News, BBC, it's on every night. There's so much interest in algae. And why is that? Why are people so excited about algae? If you look at it, and if you look at the video, think about the video that we just watched, and a couple of the points from that would be 3/4 of our oxygen comes from algae. So not the rainforest, it comes from algae. And when you think about things such as algal blooms and how awful they are, well, that's just algae doing their work. So they are mopping up excess nutrients from fertilizer, from farm runoff. They're converting CO2 into oxygen for us. So a true entrepreneur might think about that and think, what's the opportunity there? You think about also all the different types of algae that grow, and you think, where are the opportunities? So one of the big areas of opportunities is with fuel. And you can see up here that people are looking at it for powering cars. An airplane flew on just algae oil. There's a fleet within the Navy that is going on algae. So a lot of money is being pumped into algae research for biofuels. So government money, private investors, and a lot of big oil companies are all putting money into this. The problem with it has really been cost. They can't get down to the cost that makes it feasible. So if you look at the biggest company that's been working on this research, in the first 9 months of last year, they lost $58 million. So it's got a long way to go. What they're doing is saying, okay, what other parts can we pull or components can we pull out of that to kind of make some money on the side? Skincare is a huge area. They figure, you know, women, and actually a lot more men now, are looking at ways to put off aging, and they'll spend a lot of money for it. Crazy things like snake venom, you know, to freeze the lines on your face. So skincare is an area that a lot of people are looking at, taking components from algae and adding it in there, mainly for anti-aging. I think this one's kind of interesting. It's on the plastic side. Again, this company really thought forward and thought, okay, if we're going to be making all this algae for biofuel and extracting the oil, what are we going to do with the biomass that's left over? A lot of people say we'll use it for animal feed, but that's probably not really realistic because of the chances of contaminants, residue of extraction solvents. So this group said, okay, let's look at, can we use it for plastic? So they patented a polypropylene that contains 20% of the algae residue in it. And they're really wanting to use industrial spent biomass from algae. And they thought that was going to be years down the line. But they found that there's already some available. So you can see up there in the corner, there's some hair barrettes. Also headbands, different things that are already being produced in France that have 20% algae biomass from this company. So they are somebody that said, okay, this is an opportunity or is going to be an opportunity. Let's start working on it. Another crazy one, kind of. Building just opened up in Germany last week, and their thought was to put algae panels all on the front of it. They were wanting to do this. They thought, oh, it'll look great, and the algae can actually power the building. If you've worked with photosynthetic algae at all, you kind of know that this building's not really going to be so pretty. A lot of it's going to turn brown. You don't always have sunlight. You don't always have ideal temperatures. There's a lot of logistical problems with how you're going to get this algae out. So This one is interesting, and a lot of architectural groups have been looking at making algae buildings for a few years, so we'll keep an eye on this one. Another big area with algae is human health supplements. This is a huge growing area, growing industry. People like to take, think that it's easier to take a pill than to eat well. So a lot of it is going into developing human health supplements, but also pharmaceuticals. They're starting to do a lot of research with components from algae for cancer research. So what are algae? You know, when we say algae, are we just talking about one thing? We really aren't. You can see here a lot of different types of algae. These are all algae. So what you think of in your fish tank when you clean it and you're not so happy, yes, that is algae. What we have up in the corner on the ice caps, that is algae. The large types like seaweed, again, algae. So if you look at these, you can see they look very different. Some have pigments, some don't. Some grow on ice, some grow salt water, fresh water. So you've got to consider they're all very different and each one with different opportunities. There can be two major types. Microalgae are microscopic organisms. To see the individual cells, you would have to look under a microscope. But they tend to colonize, so you can see them, and something like the algal blooms are actually microalgae. Also macroalgae, which is large plant-like algae, and this would be like seaweed. So how did algae survive and adapt and grow? And that's very interesting because the oldest fossil right now is at 3.1 billion years old, and it is something that looks like an algae that was found on a fig tree fossil out of South Africa. So they are really looking back that the oldest organism that they can find is algae at this point. Algae grows very quickly, so it can outgrow or grow faster than any of its predators can eat it. It also adapts very quickly, so it can adapt to changing conditions, such as temperature, lack of water, lack of nutrients. And that's what's led to there being over 800,000 different species of algae. So huge, huge range, and think about the opportunities. So then where is algae in the food chain? And if you look at it, it's at the very base of the food chain. And we saw that in the video. We saw that you have all the different algae in the sea, and the krill and small crustaceans will actually eat it, then larger fish eat it, and then larger fish. So actually, more organisms eat algae than any other organism. Composition of algae is extremely variable. As I mentioned, there's all different types. So you can have algae that can be very high in protein or low in protein. You can have another algae that will grow and be very high in fat. We've produced one that's we can do in the lab at over 85% fat. And on commercial scale, we produce it routinely at over 70%. You can have other algae that are very high in carbohydrates. And also, you can change the algae composition by the way you grow it or the nutrients you feed it. Again, if you're really thinking about this, you know, what are the opportunities? So there's two ways to grow algae. The traditional one that you all would think of is it needs sunlight. It uses photosynthesis and grows like a plant. So this would be the ones that are outside in ponds, raceways. You can do it in bags and tubes. With this, you are very, you have to rely on the environmental conditions. So you need it to be a pretty stable temperature because big temperature fluctuations will cause your algae to not grow and some contaminating organism might grow. So it's very hard to be traceable in that system. So contaminants plus physical contaminants, if you think of birds, animals, anything that's open to the environment. So this is a very inconsistent process because you are reliant on sunlight and temperatures. The other way that you can grow algae is heterotrophic. And this would be in closed systems with no sunlight. So in this way, you're growing it a lot like you would a yeast, in a closed vessel, very controlled. You're controlling temperature, you're controlling pH, mixing speed, oxygen, the nutrients you feed it. So in this system, it's very traceable, very consistent, and you can really control the quality of it. So why is Alltech looking at algae? If you think about algae and you think about the talk we had from Professor McLaughlin on Monday on core competency, Alltech's core competency is fermentation, specifically of yeast. You see some of our yeast facilities that we have around the world, and a nice adjacency to that would be algae. We've spent over 30 years, doing research and making products on yeast, which only has about 200 species. Now we have 800,000 to look at. So I think it'll keep us busy for a while, and we have additional plants that we can look at growing it. We started this in about 2007 at our headquarters in Nicholasville, and again, we were growing it without sunlight, so closed vessels. In 2008, 2009, we moved out to another project where we were looking at doing the photosynthetic type of algae growth. Why were we doing this? One of the main drivers in Kentucky is coal production. This is also true in China. So a lot of coal is used, and with coal, you are putting off a lot of CO2 into the environment. So we wanted to look at, could we use algae growth to help try to clean up some of that? So if you look at this and you start up in the corner here, you have got your coal plant, and it's putting off CO2 and nitrous oxide to the environment. We wanted to capture that in our algae tubes. So then we are reducing the amount of CO2 to the environment. We have a nice algae biomass. From that, we could extract oil for fuel. We could use the biomass for feed. Great. So we spent 2 years there on this project. We learned a lot about growing autotrophic algae in Kentucky. We don't get quite enough sunlight here. Our temperatures are all over the place. It was very difficult to grow. We did manage to grow it, and we did a very good job of taking up carbon and nitrogen, just like we thought we would. But the problem is the flue gas off the power plant also had other contaminants. Algae acts like a sponge. It loves to take up nutrients. So we also took up very nice levels of mercury and arsenic, which we obviously could not use in feed. So we kind of thought, that's not the way we want to go on that. We need to look at a clean carbon source. Then this facility that we'd been looking at down the road for quite a few years became available. So we purchased it in 2010 and then started doing our heterotrophic algae production there. Again, you might say, why? Why is Alltech interested in this? We've all seen this slide with the population growth that we're going to be expecting over the next 20 years. And we all know that people have constant information. I'm not saying they're smarter or more knowledgeable, but they have a lot of information. There's constant news. If you don't hear the news the first time around, you can watch it on your DVR. You can listen to satellite radio anywhere you go, and if you miss that, you've got a podcast. So we have lots and lots of information. So now people don't just want food. They want that food to be nutritious. They want it to be safe. They want it to be traceable. They want the animals to be well cared for. They want it to be health enhancing. They might not know what all that means, but that is what is demanded now. So what do they really want? If you listen to Dr. Wang on Monday, one thing they want is DHA. They want a good source of DHA because of a lot of the health problems that we have going on today. So what is DHA? DHA is an omega-3 fatty acid. It's one of the ones that's often called a good fat. And where do you normally get it? You would normally get it from fish or fish products such as fish meal and fish oil. But if you remember back to the movie, fish don't create or they don't produce that DHA. They actually get it through the food chain. It's originating from the algae. So let's talk a little bit about fatty acids. And I'm going to oversimplify this a little bit, but if you have the category fatty acids, and then you have the saturated and unsaturated, In the unsaturated, we have two types, the monounsaturated, polyunsaturated, often called PUFA. Then under that, omega-6 and omega-3. So here we're getting to the omega-3, which we're all familiar with. Everybody knows, let's eat omega-3. But all omega-3s are not the same. There are quite a few omega-3 fatty acids, but I'm just going to talk about three of them. Alpha-linolenic acid, which is ALA, we have EPA and DHA. So are they all the same? And they're not. ALA, which is the most common one, is really a source of energy and for metabolic support. Its main value is that it can be converted to EPA and DHA. However, that is very, very inefficient. The conversion of ALA to DHA, about 5% in men, maybe up to 10% at maximum in women. And that really depends on your age, what you eat, a lot of different things. So if you're taking or you're eating omega-3 products that are based on ALA, which you probably don't know unless you really look at the label, you would have to eat a whole lot of that to get the real thing that you want, which is DHA. So then if we look at EPA, its main purpose is really for inflammation, or its main benefit. And then again, it can be converted to DHA. Then DHA is the one we're going to talk about a lot. Main things with it are brain and eye development, heart health, immunity. So a lot of good different things. So again, why do we care about that? If you look at DHA in young children, it's very common. About all infant formulas now will have DHA in them. And that's because it's so important for brain and eye development. And if you look at it, young children at about 3 years old need 150 milligrams a day for really good eye and brain support. The typical average amount that they're getting is 19 milligrams a day. So you really see that they're not getting the levels that they should. Are kids going to eat more fish? Three-year-olds, probably not. So what are the opportunities there? The other place that is really important with DHA is for pregnant women. And you look at that, and it's really to support the DHA levels, maternal DHA levels, provide DHA in the breast milk, provide DHA to the development of the eye and brain in the fetus. So most young mothers are very aware of the importance of DHA. What about adults? Do adults need it? Are they going to benefit? If you look at cardio health, coronary health, this is a map again from 2002, and I thought this was surprising. The three top numbers, or the countries with the highest level of deaths, are number one is India, Russia, and China. Then if you look at the U.S., in the U.S., 600,000 people a year die from coronary health disease. That is one out of every four deaths, and it hits women and men equally. It costs us about $108 billion a year. That's huge. More than 60% of the global burden of coronary health disease developing countries. It's the leading cause of death worldwide. So this is a huge, huge problem. So why are we talking about that? DHA. The American Heart Association recommends that if you have an incident or documented coronary health disease, you should be eating 1 gram per day of the combination of DHA and EPA. The general population should be eating at least 2 servings per week of oily or healthy fish that would have high levels of DHA. So again, we get back to the problems. So we're going to go back to our sources of raw materials, which are fish meal and fish oil. Okay, that's a good source of DHA, so why do we care? DHA, or fish meal and fish oil, are pretty inconsistent right now. They're unsustainable. There's problems with availability. Quality's always an issue. So if you look at quality, and there's a lot of documentation on high levels of things like heavy metals, such as mercury, and dioxins, PCBs, in fish meal, fish oil. So that's something that's been pretty common that you really have to watch. Another problem, sustainability. With farming of fish, which is the fastest growing farming segment, it takes 3 pounds or 3 kilos of wild fish to produce each one of farm fish. That's not sustainable. So that is something that needs to be addressed. If you look at one of our top areas for getting fish meal and fish oil down in Peru, the end of last year they had to really reduce the quota that they could fish. And again, this is due to overfishing, something that we all know and is well documented. So if there's not enough fish meal and fish oil, and aquaculture is one of the fastest growing segments, what are we doing? If you look at a fish formula or feed formula, you can see this is fish meal and the levels are going down in the diet. Fish oil and the levels are going down. They're being replaced with vegetable meals and vegetable oils. Okay, so what? If you look at vegetable meals, vegetable oils, they're very high in omega-6, and they do not have omega-3. Again, if you're looking over here at fish, is where you get the omega-3. So therefore, when we make that switch from fish meal and fish oil to vegetable meal, vegetable oil, that's what we're losing out on. We're losing out on the omega-3s, therefore the DHA. If you look at trout that you bought in the grocery store in 2005, and you can see the EPA DHA level at about 15%, 2008 it had dropped to 6%. So you can see that by the lack of availability of these raw materials and the changes that are made, what the effect is on that healthy fish that you're supposed to eat twice a week. Is that now going to go up to that you need to eat 4 times a week when we're not already not eating the 2 servings we should be? So again, fish oil and the availability of it is going to limit the aquaculture business. So what do we do about that? Again, if you go back to microalgae, the normal way of getting to the fish meal and fish oil is to go through the crustaceans and the fish chain. Why don't we just go straight to growing it to produce that DHA directly? Makes sense. We did a trial where we looked at replacing all of the fish oil and part of the fish meal with a high level of algae, just to see if it would the fish would eat it, if there would be any negatives on growth, and what the DHA level was. As you can see, the DHA level was about double of where it was in the control, so we do know that you can do that. It's something that is feasible. What other opportunities are there? So again, you look at our algae, it's high in DHA. We can feed it to a variety of animals. And what are the benefits going to be? It's going to be twofold. Where I've talked about all the benefits to infants and to humans, you're going to have those same health benefits to the animal. Also, you can enrich the meat, the eggs, the milk, and get to the human. So we can go through the food chain that way. Again, if we look at our meat, milk, and eggs as if they're all the same, we just go to the store and buy a commodity, then that's how they're going to be treated. So let's say, what can we do? Can we try to feed the algae to layers and get DHA-enriched eggs? And then is it going to taste bad? So this is just a quick trial that shows with increasing levels of algae fed to the layers, we get increasing levels of DHA in the eggs. So we've proven that on several occasions. Then let's see if it tastes bad. So we send samples of eggs that have a high level of the algae, so this is higher than you would commercially do, versus control eggs to the University of Kentucky Food Science Department for a sensory evaluation. And what they found was there was no statistical preference for the DHA or the control egg, except with when it was scrambled. And then actually the DHA egg was preferred. So yes, we can do it, and yes, it tastes good. What about meat? Can we do the same thing with meat? So again, we fed it to broilers, and you can see increasing levels of DHA in the breast meat when you add the algae at different levels. Same thing if you look at the EPA plus DHA in a total omega, but what we're really looking at is here. So you add more algae, you get more DHA in the meat. looked at thigh meat, because thigh meat is higher in fat, which means it's going to have higher levels of DHA. And again, we find increasing levels, you get increasing levels in the meat. The other thing we wanted to look at was that omega-6 to omega-3 ratio, because there's a lot of information out there right now with, as the Western diet has changed, we're eating more processed food, we're eating animals that are being grown intensively with a lot more vegetable products, a lot more DDG. So whereas humans evolved at about a 1-to-1 ratio of omega-6 to omega-3, in Western diets, it's up to about 15-to-1 right now. So that's a huge, huge shift. And there's a lot of work that's been done on that if you actually reduce that 15-to-1 down to about a 4-to-1 ratio, you can reduce the mortality from cardiovascular health disease by about 70%. You can also have an effect on things like inflammation for arthritis, asthma, incidence of different parts of cancer. So a huge benefit to reducing that ratio. So if you look at our control meat, it's in that 11-to-12-to-1 range, so pretty close to the Western diet. And by adding the algae and increasing the DHA, you can reduce that ratio down to what is considered a healthy level. So doesn't this make sense? When we showed what the cost of coronary health disease is for the world, and you look at a change like this and how dynamic of an effect it can have. So what about ruminants? Can we do the same thing there? And this is pretty recent work, but what you hear a lot with ruminants is that, oh, is it going to affect the rumen? Are you going to have decrease in productivity? And what about the DHA? Is it going to even get through the rumen? So we did some quick work looking at it, and here we're looking at volatile fatty acids through the rumen at different levels of algae addition and at different time. And what you see is no statistical difference. So it did not have an effect in the rumen as far as volatile fatty acids. Then we wanted to look at DHA through the rumen. You see some little differences here at the low level, but we were told that that's really because of the level, that there really was not a significant difference in DHA through the rumen, which again shows that it is stable and that you're going to get it through the process. So this just gives you a little background and lets you see that we can really change the way that we're feeding the world. So we're not just looking at feeding the world, but feeding it in a better way.